This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham.
An Urbana Democrat tries to outflank Betsy Dirksen Londrigan from the left, including on affordable health care.
I don't think that Betsy understands what's affordable for the people in our district.
Stephanie Smith talks about single-payer health care, her youth in poverty, and running for the 13th Congressional District. Plus, part three of our series on court fines and fees. And Laura Kennedy previews a show at Illinois Wesleyan featuring faculty artwork.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Even after bipartisan efforts to improve the system of court fines and fees in Illinois, some believe it still places disproportionate burdens on low-income people here and can contribute to poverty. In part three of WGLT's series on the new Illinois Criminal and Traffic Assessment Act, Mary Cullen talks with national experts on how Illinois matches up with the rest of the country and whether this state can learn from those examples.
Lisa Foster is co-director of the Fines and Fees Justice Center, a national organization that tracks court costs around the U.S. Foster says that Illinois' Criminal and Traffic Assessment Act may look like it could work on paper, but in the real world, not so much.
Generally speaking, the fact that judges now can waive or reduce fines and fees for criminal offenses and can consider up to 400% of poverty is great, but by excluding traffic, you're excluding a huge number of people who are caught in the justice system and for whom even a traffic fine and associated fees jeopardizes their economic security.
Foster's co-director at the Fines and Fees Justice Center, Joanna Weiss, adds that for many, traffic offenses are often the entry point into the legal system.
People start out with a low-level traffic offense that nobody feels should result in jail time or perpetual punishment. But because enforcement is so heavily done in poor communities and communities of color, you end up with many people who can't afford to pay, especially as government is relying heavily on fines and fees as a means of generating revenue.
Even a small fine can have long-lasting impacts on low-income residents. Kai Ajay, a leader of Bloomington's Black Lives Matter, says one unpaid fine could increase time without a driver's license or result in jail time. Ajay says the more time passes, the harder it is for the offender to find money to pay the court costs. Lisa Foster agrees.
For even a minor traffic violation, $226 at Illinois' minimum wage is 27 hours of work. So you're asking people who are working at minimum wage, assuming they're working, to give up almost a week's salary or income for a speeding ticket.
McLean County judges say excluding waivers for traffic offenses is a way to fund the court system. Other provisions of the reform measure did reduce fines and fees, tied them closer to the offense instead of funding unrelated agencies, and offered waivers for low-income people. The act's sponsor, former Representative Steven Anderson, calls leaving out traffic offenses from waivers a practical choice.
That is such a large volume court call. The clerks felt that if we applied the waiver to the traffic court system, the system would become unmanageable because then you'd have to have a hearing for so many cases that at this stage, at least, they felt that that would just be unmanageable from a paperwork standpoint.
Anderson says lawmakers drafting the bill had to face a reality. Ben Riddell is an attorney with the ACLU of Illinois. He differs with Anderson. Riddell says courts exist to create justice, not to make the job of those working in the system easier.
They've got it backwards. The rules and the laws of the state of Illinois are not here to make the court's jobs easier and to reduce the amount of work that they have to do. That's not the goal. That's not any kind of a public policy goal.
Riddell says it's time to find a better public policy solution.
These fines and fees are perverting courts' ability to do justice. So the fact that some clerks think that it's too much work to allow judges to waive financial assessments for low-income people who are suffering because of these assessments, that's just unacceptable.
In states like Illinois, where the state does not fully fund courts, fines and fees are a common way to pay for court operations. Lisa Foster with the Fines and Fees Justice Center shares statistics from a recent Governing.com report, which found that Illinois has 33 jurisdictions that derive over 10% of their revenue from fines, fees, and forfeitures, 11 jurisdictions that derive over 20%, 4 jurisdictions that derive over 30%, and 1 that derives over 50%.
That makes Illinois certainly, in fact, number 10 in the country among states that derive a significant percentage of their revenue from fines and fees.
Foster says there are 70 jurisdictions in Illinois that earn more than $100 for every adult resident in fines and fees. She says there are better methods to fund court systems. Foster notes a 1990s pilot program that proved when fine and fee amounts are scaled to offender income, people are more willing and able to pay. Foster says the 2014 shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, sparked interest by states and municipalities on the issue of fines and fees. A week after Brown's death, a report found the city of just over 21,000 people brought in $2.6 million in fines and fees in 2013. That's $124 for every adult resident in Ferguson. The report added fuel to the existing protest over racial aspects of Brown's killing. Foster says media coverage may have scared some jurisdictions into finding a better funding option. In 2017, for example, Foster says Texas passed a law regarding fine-only cases, where the penalty is a fine with no possibility of incarceration. She says Texas judges must assess an offender's ability to pay before sentencing.
If they determine that the person cannot afford the amount of fines and fees that would ordinarily be imposed, the judge can waive or reduce the fines and fees, convert those fines and fees to community service, put the person on a payment plan, or any combination of those.
Foster says within 1 year, Texas saw the amount the courts collected went up, even though the overall fines and fee amounts went down.
That's, we think, because when people can actually imagine paying the amount that's imposed, because it's based on their economic circumstances, and you give them a reasonable payment plan, a way to pay it, they do.
Foster says when payment feels impossible, offenders are much more likely to throw their hands up and walk away because they know it's out of reach. When that happens, the court often gets no money at all. San Francisco provides another example. Foster says the West Coast city eliminated a range of fees and implemented a low-income payment plan. She says the city collected almost 3 times as much in court costs. Foster says jurisdictions often don't give the policy a chance because on the surface it looks counterintuitive. And after so many years of things just being that way, many jurisdictions are reluctant to change. Foster's co-director has a more controversial explanation of why counties, states, and municipalities don't embrace income-based fines and fees. Joanna Weiss says the issue lies in the model of self-funded courts.
When you have actors in the court whose salaries are dependent on money coming in from fines and fees, they're terrified of making any changes that are going to affect their budgets.
Weiss says no one in the court should have their paycheck tied to the fines and fees they assign to offenders, despite it being a common practice across the U.S. Mark Fellheimer, the chief judge for McLean County, says raising funds for the courts is not on any judge's mind. They're just doing their job.
When I impose a fine or I impose an assessment, we impose what's appropriate. We deal with the ability to pay as part of that as well as a waiver. So it's touchy to start saying that if judges are involved as far as the system itself, yes, we are, but I don't view it as were attempting to collect money for the court system.
Fellheimer says the law itself was not written by judges, and they have to abide by the statute. He says the judge's primary concern is implementing the law as intended, which he says McLean County's judges are doing well. Supporters of change might have another bite at the apple. The new Criminal and Traffic Assessment Act that took effect in July is a trial run. It sunsets after a year and a half. The Illinois General Assembly will review court revenue data next spring to see whether policymakers think the law is working. I'm Mary Cullen.
Mary Cullen prepared this series, the John J. Arnold Fines and Fees Justice Reporting Fellowship Project. Look back and listen to all three parts of the series at our website, wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas.
WGLT is a service of Illinois State University, the first public university in the state of Illinois. Since 1966, Illinois State has partnered with listeners and local business underwriters to bring you this public radio station and its services. More information at illinoisstate.edu and at wglt.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan could have a Democratic primary opponent next spring before her planned rematch against Congressman Rodney Davis. Democrat Stephanie Smith is also planning a run in the 13th Congressional District. She was born in Normal, raised in Leroy, and is now living in Urbana. The 36-year-old works in township government on poverty, homelessness, and sexual violence issues. She spoke to me via Skype about her first run for office.
Growing up, I experienced a great deal of poverty, and I was homeless off and on throughout my life. In my teen years, when I was experiencing homelessness, I started doing underage survival sex work, which is labeled as child sex trafficking. And so a lot of my work has been around issues of agency, autonomy, sexual violence, and just trying to really take a survivor-led and trauma-informed approach to these issues, because I feel like our social services lack that and can actually be more traumatic for the populations affected by the sexual violence that accompanies poverty.
Why are you running for Congress?
Because I didn't see anybody qualified to represent me or other working people. I didn't see anybody speaking about the issues that I believe are important in our district. We have such high levels of poverty, housing insecurity, food insecurity. We have low wages. I really, health insurance is such a huge problem. Like, these are life and death issues for working class people, and I'm not seeing other candidates speak about them in ways that I find reassuring.
What are going to be the issues that you focus on most closely over the next 6 months, 12 months?
So I actually like to take a holistic approach to the issues, because I believe all of these things are very much interconnected. So when we talk about environmentalism, for example, we need to talk about ecological justice and housing discrimination and who winds up in more polluted environments and how does that affect their health. Like, all of these things are connected, right? So really, a lot of other politicians sort of take the concerns from the people at the top, and then maybe they get to the concerns of the people that are marginalized eventually. I'm taking the opposite approach. Basically, the concerns of the people most affected by decades of bad policy, those are the people that are informing my work regarding policy. And so while I have some things that are deeply personal to me that I want to work on, I really view myself as somebody that is working more for a movement than for my own political agenda.
Can you contrast yourself with the other announced Democratic candidate in the race up to this point, to Betsy Londrigan?
I try to be very specific about housing insecurity and health care. I believe both of those things are human rights. And that's part of the reason that I'm running, is that when I hear people talk about affordable health care, affordable is an amorphous term. I currently am in a position in which I have quote unquote affordable health care. And it's not affordable, right? Like, I can't afford the co-pays. I can't afford the fees for specialists. I can't afford premiums. And
I don't think that Betsy understands what's affordable for the people in our district. We have 60% of our district eligible for SNAP, for example, and Betsy's version of affordable does not reflect my version of affordable. It's too amorphous. It needs context. And I stand firmly in the belief that healthcare is a human right, and we need access to healthcare.
So if healthcare is a human right, what should Congress do to make healthcare more accessible to everybody?
Fight for single-payer healthcare.
How do you get that through Congress? What is the argument you make to folks who are skeptical of that idea? They're scared in some way by an idea that big.
On the world stage, many of the countries that have single-payer healthcare are considerably healthier populations than the U.S. The only people that I really know who are afraid of these ideas are people that have been reading a lot of information that's coming from industry lobbyists that has been very much influenced by like pharmaceutical companies and that sort of thing. I think there's a misconception that healthcare actually costs as much as we are forced to pay, and that is a lie. So I think if people are concerned about how we pay for it, I think we need to talk about ending the corruption that we have in the pharmaceutical industry, in the health insurance industry, and that is probably a really good starting point.
Well, earlier you mentioned that you see issues as very interconnected. So when you think of the environment, you think of ecological justice and sort of associated issues. Specifically on the environment, that is an issue a lot of our listeners care deeply about. What are things that you would want to see a Congress pass, the next Congress pass, if you were to win and join that group in the beginning of 2021?
I think the Green New Deal is very important. I also support policies like the Homes Guarantee that has components of like energy efficiency and addressing environmental pollution built in. Right. So I feel like we need to address the environment at every intersection. I'm displeased by this notion that this is an individual problem, that somehow we can recycle our way out of it, that we could just use a different type of plastic or switch to, you know, mason jars instead of Solo cups. I think that really obfuscates that the people who are doing the most damage to our world have a great amount of power, and they're not being held accountable when we shift the burden to individualism. So I think the biggest thing that we need to do for the environment is focus on collective action and movement.
So what are the parts of the Green New Deal proposal that you like the most?
Honestly, I really like that it addresses infrastructure, because that fits in with one of our big issues that people in poverty face, which is low wages, right? So I really feel like when we talk about these policies, when I talk about holistic policies, you know, we're looking at this from an economic justice perspective as well. So I think one of the most exciting things about the Green New Deal that I think gets sort of glossed over is that I believe that there is truly the ability to revitalize our economy in a way that benefits working class people.
What do you make of Congressman Rodney Davis's tenure so far in the U.S. House?
I am really disappointed lately with his support of Donald Trump and his take on impeachment. I think that the farm bill has not helped our small farmers in our region. I think that the lack of transparency in his office, the fact that he does not come to our region to actually discuss issues with his constituency, I think that's horrible. Our elected officials are there to represent us, and I believe that he is failing at that task.
So how would you win in a district like this? You know, the 13th district is, it's huge, first of all. It touches on a lot of college towns. It's also very rural. It's a very tough district for either party to win in. How would you go about doing that?
I just follow my heart, honestly. The driving ethos behind what I am doing is that I will not do anything that violates someone else's human rights. And I think that that message speaks to people. To me, this is less about winning. It's less about competition and more about connection. I believe in leadership through service. And so for me, I'm not looking at this as something where I need to win against Betsy and Rodney in the traditional sense that politics is framed at. As I'm looking at this as an opportunity to demonstrate to the people of my district that I want to serve them, that I would be honored to represent them, and that they have the right to make an empowered choice when it comes to choosing their representation. So for me, like, how am I going to win? Well, that's not up to me. That's up to everyone else. And I think it's really important that when we talk about democracy, we get rid of this sort of war language around it, because it's about what the people need and finding representation that respects that.
Or who are some elected officials, you know, past or present, that you look up to, that you would want to emulate or be like, should you win?
I have to say that 2018, while a disappointing election for my district in terms of Congress, has been really exciting in terms of the squad, right? We've had so many groundbreaking congressional runs in 2018. And really, that inspires me. That makes it feel possible for me. I think prior to seeing that, I believed that, and this is still predominantly true, but I believed that politics was a rich man's game. You know, the sort of people that have been allowed access to those spaces, even on more local levels, are incredibly privileged. And it has always felt like people were making decisions about me, not for me. And in 2018, I finally felt like I was seeing real representation come out of some of these congressional races. And that's very, very exciting.
That's Democratic congressional candidate Stephanie Smith. If they both get on the ballot, Smith and Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan would face off in the March 2020 primary. The winner would face Republican Rodney Davis next November. This is Sound Ideas. Race and healthcare have a troubled history together. Look no further than the infamous Tuskegee syphilis experiment 90 years ago, when over 100 innocent black men were infected with the disease and died from its effects. Today, race plays a different but still substantial role in the care that patients receive. On the front lines are nurses, including nurses of color. Advocate Broman nurse Kiana Wilkinson is vice president of the Black Nurses Association of Central Illinois. She spoke to WGLT's student reporter Tiffany Jackson about representation in healthcare and her own journey into nursing, which was sparked by losing her father to Lou Gehrig's disease while still in high school.
With being with him in that process, seeing the nurses involved in all the hospital visits and the intensive care units, I made the choice to go into nursing because I get to see the patient there like more than the doctor can. I get to see them in a capacity that's greater than anyone else can. And just to be there for people in their time of need and in times where you don't understand the diagnosis, you know, there's a lot that goes into it. And I think that was a decision that brought me into becoming a nurse and to going into healthcare ultimately too.
So how was your experience in nursing school? Did you have any obstacles that ultimately played a role in where you are today?
I would say yes. Getting into nursing school was a difficult feat. At first, I tried to get into ISU's nursing program, and I was told to not even try. They're very high requirements, and when I looked at the program, there weren't many black faces in the program, and that almost was a deterrent, but I kept going. So I got my associate's degree at Heartland Community College, and then I applied at Methodist College in Peoria. And there was a black director there who I met with her, and I think she was one of the persons that helped me get through. And I was one of four black students graduating in the nursing program, you know, when we graduated. And I just saw the need for more black faces, more stories that are like mine. Nursing has a, I would say, a racist history. Mm-hmm. National Black Nurses Association came about because American Nurses Association wouldn't allow black nurses to have their own association or to just have a voice, you know, with everyone else in America. So we came about because of the separation. And as a result, we are able to have a voice. We are able to advocate for people like us and to get more voices out there. So I feel like for me right now, I work in the Progressive Care Unit at Advocate Broman Hospital. It's a neurological unit. And I also am there because of my father. He had a neurological disease. Mm. And I am also there because strokes are very prevalent in the black community. We also deal with seizures and back surgeries and other neurological things like brain surgery as well. So I feel like my history with my father, as well as seeing how there's not a lot of representation out there, push me into where I am at and where I continue to strive and be.
What was the most rewarding part of becoming a nurse for you?
Just seeing how they influence me, patients influence me, and how I can influence them. Like, I went to school, I'm knowledgeable about the body, anatomy and physiology, but what patients give to me is they're going through the sickness. They're going through everything. I don't feel the pain. And to see them still smile or to see them still get up and walk and keep moving is very rewarding and encouraging to keep on moving in life overall. You know, like, I don't have any major illnesses, but I can be there for people who do or do have other shortcomings or anything like that, and just to help them be strong, you know, and just to say that I'm there and they're not alone.
So you're the vice president of the Central Illinois chapter of the Black Nurse Association, which formed nationally in the 1970s because African Americans couldn't get a voice in the American Nurse Association. It's grown from there, including your local chapter in 2014. So Kiana, what inspired you to get involved with the group?
There's not a lot of representation, not a lot of teachers that you see that look like you, not a lot of students that look like you as well. So going through that route, Black Nurses Association is going to help with black nurses who want to get through and finish the program and become thriving nurses. As well as we offer mentoring. We have the people in our team are magnificent. Our president, Dr. Elaine Hardy, is a dean at University of Illinois at Peoria of nursing students. She's awesome, and she's a great mentor, and she's my mentor. And I just love her because she was the reason why I got into black nurses in the first place. She came to visit us at Methodist College, and I immediately was like, yes, this is where I need to be, because we need more black nurses, and we need the empowerment that she offers. I'm vice president. We have our secretary, Jennifer Mata. She's a nurse up in Aurora. She's Hispanic, and she's representing for that, you know, part of nursing. We have, I'm trying to think, Ebony Wright. She's our health policy liaison. She is working on her doctorate right now in population health. So someone else you can talk to. She's gone through nursing school. We've all gone through nursing school, and we all can be a resource for everybody. Last but not least, we have our treasurer, Regetta Harris. She's a nurse right now through OSF. She has her master's degree. So that is our executive board, and I feel like through us, we can make a difference through students because we've been there and we know what to expect, and we can help you on the other side because we're thriving in our careers as well.
So do you think healthcare orgs like hospitals and colleges are doing enough to diversify the workforce?
I think they could do more. Mm-hmm. I'm at the hospital I work at, I am one of a handful, I would say at least five. There's at least one black nurse on every department. But there needs to be more. There needs to be more diversity, like Asians, Hispanics, like everybody. It needs to be representative of our world. Like, we're not just a white world. We're not just, you know, this. We are all together. We're all working together. And sickness is not racist at all. It does not choose you because of your color. It chooses everybody based on genetics and a bunch of other things. So I feel like we need to be representative. We need to be respectful of other people's cultures. We need to be present and listening into what people need, you know, their needs specifically, because we're not all the same, you know, and we need that inclusion.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Tiffany Jackson. I'm here with the vice president of the Central Illinois chapter of the Black Nurse Association, Kiana Wilkinson. How important is it for patients to be treated by people who look like them or come from similar backgrounds?
Definitely. I would say when I come in to help patients and I see them as the same color as I am, they trust me. Healthcare and black people don't have a really good relationship as far as trust. And just to be able to see someone who can relay the information in a way that they can understand, to have someone who they can talk to have someone that can, you know, listen, for my lifestyle, or just be able to understand your lifestyle better. Like, with being a Black person, I understand that it's hard to sometimes have the structure in your home like, you know, you wish you could have. So I'll think of different techniques, like with my upbringing. Yes, my mom did not like me taking medications or, you know, doing this. So to do that, maybe plan to take your medication at school, or, you know, just different things like that can just bring insight and more information and create a better community that will listen to, you know, the healthcare needs that they have. You know, like, listen, your diet needs to be changed because of this. You can't tell someone that from a perspective of, this is wrong, you're not supposed to do this. It has to come from a different place. And people will be more willing to listen if you change how you approach them and if you have someone that looks like you.
So there are many diseases that really impact the Black community. For example, sickle cell anemia. So why do you think that it's important for the community to know and be educated about these diseases?
Definitely. Well, sickle cell anemia, I've heard those type of patients be described as drug seekers. They're always in pain, or their symptoms are dramatized, and that is not true at all. Like, we don't know how it is to have sickle cell. I don't have it, and I don't know how it is to have it. And we should not be judging people's reactions or symptoms based on this clinical box of how it should be presented. I feel like, as well as I work on neurological floor, so strokes, trying to tackle people's diet, you know, let them know that heredity plays a huge part as well. I just think that we need to be more sensitive. We see this a lot. Like, as a healthcare professional, we see these type of symptoms and diseases a lot, but it doesn't mean that it can be, how can I say it, categorizes they all act like this, you know, to stereotype them. I feel like we just need to have more understand that different people will have different symptoms. They will have different ways of coping, and we need to respect that and also give them techniques on maybe to do this. You've done it this way because it works for you. How about trying it this way? Like, changing how we approach them using a therapeutic communication, and then just getting to a solution that way.
Overall, you've worked with many patients, and sometimes you get a patient who you establish a really good connection with. Mm-hmm. Have you ever had an experience where a patient has stayed with you in a meaningful way, even after you've taken care of them?
Yes, many, many times. It's hard not to get that connection with patients when you're spending so much time with them. And I feel that it's so rewarding in here. Like, a lot of people say nursing is a thankless job, but I feel like I receive a lot of thanks. And I'm very grateful of that, because I try to show them that I appreciate them and allowing me to take care of them. They stay with me in ways that help me grow as a nurse, because I'm more respectful. Every time I see someone like me or someone different than me, I listen. I'm more patient. I just try to, just be someone that they need. Like, I change how I am based because of their needs. Like, I meet them where they're at. And I feel like that is very important, because healthcare is not this one thing. It's very personalized, and it should be incorporated that way when we give care.
So what is the ultimate goal of the Black Nurses Association? What impact are you all seeking to make on the healthcare climate of today?
We are just trying to bring awareness. We are trying to get in the community, and we go to a lot of healthcare fairs. We do blood sugar checks, we do blood pressure checks, we do health counseling. We just try to promote, you know, healthy eating habits, healthy lifestyle habits. We also are trying to help with our nurses here in the community. So Illinois State nurses, we've got Heartland Community College nurses, Illinois Wesleyan, just trying to show that we are in the community, we are helping, and there are ways for you to be a part of us and help us grow.
That's Kiana Wilkinson, the Vice President of the Black Nurses Association of Central Illinois, speaking with WGLT's student reporter, Tiffany Jackson. Wilkinson says they're always looking for more members for Downstate Illinois. Their website is nbna.org. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for WGLT comes from the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Black Violin and their unique blend of classical and hip-hop music known as Classical Boom on Thursday, October 17th at 7:30. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. A new survey from the University of Illinois at Springfield and public radio station WUIS shows a majority of those responding feel Illinois is on the wrong track. But they're more positive when it comes to the job performance of the governor. IPR's Sean Crawford talked with State House Editor Brian Mackey about the results.
Brian, Governor J.B. Pritzker has been in office for about 9 months. This survey finds Illinois residents are pleased with him so far. Nearly 60% answered they approve of the job he's doing.
Yeah, and that's true among all the different ways you, just about every different way you can slice these responses, whether you're looking at gender, both men and women. He's above water there, a little more popular with women than he is with men. All different age groups approve of how he's doing. It's even true among the various regions of Illinois. As you would expect, he's most popular in Cook County, about 70% approval rating there. That's where Chicago is located. But even in the collar counties, 56% approval. And downstate, he's just barely above half the people approve how he's doing. Same thing when you look at the breakdown of people based on their ethnicity or race, racial identity. He's got well over 4 out of 5 African-Americans think he's doing a good job. Latinos approve of his performance. Among whites, it's 50-50. The one weak spot in his approval ratings, as you would expect, are among people who are Republicans. Just under a third of them think that he's doing a good job.
Well, still, despite those relatively high approval ratings, a majority of those responding to this survey, 56%, say the state is on the wrong track. Even a majority of those who identify as Democrat feel that way. And that's interesting when you compare that, again, to that approval rating of Governor Pritzker.
And I guess that's not too surprising because there is a lot of bad news that comes out about Illinois. Now, this particular poll was taken before the latest political scandal erupted around state government, before the raids on Senator Martin Sandoval's offices. But you have editorial boards who are constantly saying what a terrible shape the state is in. Bond rating agencies have a lot of negative things to say about the amount of pension liabilities that Illinois still has to come up with. Well, more than $100 billion to eventually get up to a full funding level. So there is a lot of bad news about Illinois, and it can be difficult to remain optimistic. But the governor pursued a broad agenda. It was a popular agenda, or populist agenda even, and included things like legalizing marijuana, which is something that's generally fairly popular. And so he seems to be reaping the benefits of his and the Democratic supermajority and the General Assembly's legislative accomplishments.
This survey looked at Illinois' economy, and a pretty low number, only 23% thought that Illinois' economy was in good or excellent shape. Also interesting that about 70% think that things really won't get much better over the next year. And we already know Illinois is losing population. So some questions in this survey looked at whether people have considered leaving the state. What did we learn from those?
Yeah, I thought this was done in a very interesting way. So it first asked the question, have you thought about leaving Illinois? And 61% of people said that they had. And that was specifically in the past year. And that's something that I guess with all the doom and gloom we were just talking about a moment ago is not too surprising. But then the survey went on to try and get a little more specific about that and ask people, have you looked at a job? Have you applied for a job in a new state? Looked at housing, looked up the cost of living. And for those numbers, it was a lot lower. So people say they've considered leaving Illinois for anything from finding a better job to better weather to lower state tax rates. But in terms of actually doing what you would have to do to leave the state, far fewer people are taking those steps than are just saying, yeah, I've thought about it.
That's State House editor Brian Mackey. He talked with Sean Crawford about survey findings from the WUIS and the University of Illinois at Springfield. The survey of more than 1,000 registered voters was conducted in September, and additional results will be released in the coming days. Now turning to the world of art. The art faculty at Illinois Wesleyan University spend their days teaching drawing, ceramics, sculpture, and more. They balance that time with time in their studios creating drawings, ceramics, sculpture, and more. Now that work is on view at Illinois Wesleyan's galleries. WGLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
The Merwin Gallery showcases the faculty biennial, currently up through October 17th. The show highlights the varied artistic talents of the professors in the School of Art, including Connie Estep, Joshua Lowe, Claire Hedden, and Carmen Lozar, who curates the galleries as well as teaches glass. Also, there's a work by design professor Mark Genrick. He's created a massive, roundish sculpture, black on the outside with portholes to the inside of the work that reveal reflective surfaces. A light shining from within projects moving abstract images across the wall. Carmen Lozar says it looks great in a lit room, but it is even more spectacular when the lights are doused.
And it makes for a great selfie when you look through one side and you can see someone else's face or yourself in these reflected mylar surface that's on the inside. It's a quite a large, ambitious sculpture. It's called Reflection Chamber, but his second title for it is Crazy Diamond.
Did he talk about what inspired him?
I think that Mark is incredibly inspired by form and as well as reflection and movement. And his work tends to be quite formal as he investigates shape. But also I think he always has this component of light and componentry as well, I would say. His work seems to really be about putting together parts and pieces to make a whole. And you can see that in the way this piece is built. It's very calming in a way to sit and look at the walls with these kind of circles traveling around on you, around you, and onto the other artwork as well.
So I guess we better put the lights on so we can see the other artworks. So let's actually go to the back. And we have Connie Estep.
Connie Estep is our painting and drawing professor. She is an amazing teacher. They say she can teach anyone to draw. She really is an amazing draftsperson, but also includes quite a bit of narrative and storytelling, just a bit of storytelling into her work. And
I'm glad you said that, because when I first looked at these, I thought, you know, they looked like illustrations from an old children's book that I might have found in a vintage store somewhere. There's whimsy, but there's also melancholy and great beauty.
I would agree with you about the whimsy and the melancholy, absolutely. And I think she uses a lot of old text as reference, you know, clip art, really old clip art, and things like that. And I think the titles on these are really poetic as well. They are all in one series. And if you look at the titles, there's Last Wish, Last Wind, Last Heart. Like, they're really beautiful. They seem to be about some sort of closure
loss, yeah.
And loss. Yeah. And then there's this sense of beauty as well that kind of is carried throughout each one. She's a great teacher, and I always love it when the teachers show what they're teaching and the students get to come down and say, oh, wow, now I know why I'm taking the class from that person, because they're very, very skilled. She's very skilled at drawing.
So is that really the core push behind doing a faculty biennial?
I think it's one of many components that makes the show always interesting to the community and the students. You always want to see who you're learning from. You always want to see what they can do as well. I think it's also a chance for really the faculty to say, this is who we are. Truly, we are teachers and we love to teach, but we're also practicing artists, and we exist in the world in a different way than just as a professor.
So moving along, we have some work in ceramics. So I know this is Claire Hedman.
Yeah, she's really an amazing artist. I'm always happy that I get to work with such amazing people, and Claire is one of those people. She constantly is impressing me with her skill and her ideas and what she comes up with that, to me, is so different from the other work in the show. She has taken kind of this idea of a candle holder, something very simple. And she has probably, within the show, 20 variations on that idea, all working with line and shadow, with these really beautiful kind of handmade thin structures. And each one, you think you have one picked out that you just is really your favorite, most unique, and then you look next door to it and you go, oh, but maybe I really enjoy that one as well. So it's amazing to me how many variations she can come up with and how gorgeous and delicate each one is. You know, they really do lend themselves to being picked up, to be carried around. They really look like an object that people could live with in their home and have on their table. And to me, I think that's quite a successful thing.
So let's move down a ways in the gallery, and we come upon the work of Joshua Lowe, and it's called Tally Marks.
Yeah, and this is a special person in this exhibition, because he's our newest faculty member here. So he is our new graphic design faculty. One of the reasons these are such incredible wall pieces is because he's a graphic designer. When we think of graphic designers, we think of people doing work for other people. So like, you're making business cards, you're making two-dimensional work, basically representing someone else. Josh is obviously an artist in his own right. He's created these six pieces that are called tally marks. And as I look at them and you look at, they're each individually titled. One's titled Ike Slept Under the Stars, 1965 to 74, west of the Mississippi. They all have these very Ike and Terry John planted seeds, 1977 to 78. So they're very interesting. They're possibly about people. They have that long linear quality of a person.
They have sort of a wood frame around them, and there's a metal bar going across, and he's strung various things, mm-hmm. various materials, threads and such, and there's also nails that have been pounded into it and incorporated as well. He's incorporated cigarettes and also clothespins.
Pins at the end. So there's some narrative, some vague narrative happening here that's referencing, I think, people he knows or a time from the past. And they're just beautifully made. When you look at these frames, these maple frames, they're just so gorgeous. And you don't often think of a designer working in a three-dimensional way. So we're so excited to have him because it makes an impression on our students when they see us working in various medium.
And last but certainly not least, Carmen, it's you.
It's me. I do
your work.
I do love your to get to show in this
glass works and some found objects as well incorporated here. And of course, when I look at these wonderful objects like nurse log, we have a woman stretched out on glass and there's something growing out of her. And I want to say, whimsy. Does the word whimsy, is that okay with you? I don't know. I don't know if some artists
absolutely.
Would appreciate
that. First of all, they're figurine-like. They're very small, so they go to that tradition. They're small, they're narrative, they're mixing, you know, reality and fantasy a bit. So I think whimsy is fine. And I think that they're sweet. A lot of them are sweet pieces. I have found that since having children, my work has gotten a little more sweet, which is always, you know, you
so
change.
So you're picking up from your kids?
Yeah, I think you fluctuate, you know, through your life as you grow and change and have new experiences. So yeah, like this piece, Nurse Log, has a actual small tree and plants, mushrooms growing out of this glass figure. A nurse log is something that we don't necessarily have around here, but in the Northwest, when a great tree is felled in the forest, other plants use that to grow out of and start new life.
So it is nursing them along.
Right, and I think of that in terms of like our relationship to the world and, you know, not only just through plants, this is really just a metaphor for a larger idea.
Next to it is one, you have glass and wood incorporated, a figure and the figure sitting on the block, and it's entitled Tied in Knots, and a glass yarn ball, mm-hmm. and her head looks like it's all tied up in yarn as well. I have to know the inspiration for this, Carmen.
I think that just our lives, it's just about our lives today. We are asked to do so much and to be so much, and we look every direction and try to do every little thing, and really it does end up tying us in knots, and it's hard to focus and take time for ourselves. So there's a very simple idea behind that piece. I think it's just a very straightforward. I think that day I made it, I was just really feeling rushed and multitasking, a little too much multitasking.
And you can't rush through glasswork either.
No, and you have to have the time and the experience and the willingness to invest in that time for a good solid day or two if you want to make something.
Next to that is one called Simply Fight, mm-hmm. and here you have incorporated some found objects of a ketchup, a little packet of ketchup and a little packet of mustard, and out of them grow these figures and they're fighting, and it gives us the age-old debate, you know, are you a ketchup person or are you a mustard person?
Absolutely. And this again goes back to having children and relating to them. And they're like, I have two daughters that are 2 years apart and they love each other dearly, but boy, they do fight a lot. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they are so different, they're just scrapping around all the time. And so I don't think that they recognize themselves in this piece, but to me it's very clear who these two characters are.
The one next to it, bubblegum.
Yes.
As well, we have charming figures coming out of wads of bubblegum.
Yes. And I think that I try to use glass as a material that responds to what I'm making. It's the best thing if you can combine your material with your idea. So in the case of the spilled ketchup or the spilled mustard, it has that shiny quality. It's kind of liquidy. It's able to look like it's coming out of those packets. With the bubble gum, you as well have this ability to stretch glass and make it look sticky and wet. So I find that using glass as a material to create imagery with spills and wet things or things that are food-like is one of my favorite things to do.
How do you balance your demands? You have demands as a teacher, you have home demands with the family, mm-hmm. and then, of course, the studio is always calling.
It's a really hard thing. In fact, this morning before I came in, I was in the studio working frantically for a little bit. And what the studio does is I think it tends to fill an artist up and make them a happier person. So even just the little hour or two I got this morning made me feel kind of refreshed and ready for the day and more internally satisfied with everything. So yeah, I think there's always that demand and the studio is always calling. That is very true. And then there's times that I have to say, okay, I'm juggling a lot. And it won't always be this intense, and I will have time for the studio. I have to think towards the future and say, you know, summers, it's really wonderful when you're a professor and you can concentrate during those summer months on your practice.
That's artist, professor, and curator Carmen Lozar. The Faculty Biennial continues through October 17th at the Merwin Gallery. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can see photos of the exhibition at the Merwin Gallery, plus hear about what's on view in the Wakely Gallery at Illinois Wesleyan at our website, wglt.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at wglt.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen, Tiffany Jackson, and Laura Kennedy. I'm Ryan Denham. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.